Hi, I'm Andy Finn, and I am begging you to listen to my show at www.andyfinn.us.
The Andy Finn Show, Uncommon Talk Radio.
We are back on the Andy Finn Show, and we're talking about David Petraeus and the evaluation of the surge. Today was day one of his testimony in front of Congress. Tomorrow, September 11th, the sixth anniversary of the 9/11 attacks, is day two. And so the initial reports are in, and it's a mixed bag, of course, as we said in the first couple segments. And what's happened is people are going to hear what they want to hear. Most supporters of the war come into this believing the surge is working and that things are going reasonably well and that maybe there's light at the end of the tunnel, to use the old Vietnam phrase. And most opponents of the war question whether Petraeus has the right view of things, point to contraindications, and there are plenty of them out there, and didn't believe in the surge in the first place, and don't believe in their gut that anything good can come of it. Now, we'll get to, in another segment, the politics of this and how this is going to play out and whether or not Bush is going to be able to keep troops at the level he wants, which is over 100,000, let's say, until he leaves office, which seems pretty likely. But let's talk a little bit more about the results that Petraeus is finding. Now, keep in mind that the original surge was going to start in January and go until, well, go 6 to 9 months. It was the original idea. Now, of course, they didn't ramp up the surge completely until June 15th is the date that most people accept. But keep in mind, that wasn't the first 21,000 that Bush said he was going to call the surge. Petraeus came back and said, I'd like another, 7,500, 8,000. And, well, Robert Gates wasn't too happy about the request for an increase. He gave it to him. And so it was June before they got all the troops in there. So if you're a supporter of the war, your attitude is, well, June 15th, July, August, it's only been less than 3 months that we've actually had all the troops there we need. So the surge is just getting started. We need 6 to 9 months, or whatever the argument is, right? But from the point of view of people that thought at the time of the 2006 election that this was a message to the Bush administration to change course on the war, from their point of view, we're closing in on a year since the American people sent that lesson to the president the beginning of November of last year. So it's all a matter of your perspective. Now, let's go back to that election, and let's go back to the Baker-Hamilton report and where this whole surge thing came from, because you don't hear this talked about too much, but some of this information has come out since then. But the Baker-Hamilton report, made up of Jim Baker and Lee Hamilton, a Republican and a Democrat, well-respected, senior elder statesman, and then five people on each side, a total of 10 people, including five Republicans, five Democrats. The Baker-Hamilton report came out after the election because they didn't want to poison the atmosphere of the election. And it basically said, it gave the Bush administration some tough medicine. It said, you should be talking to our enemies, not just our friends. That's the way diplomacy works. You need to be talking to Syria. You need to be talking to Iran about security in these areas, because you've got to consider them. If Iraq is going to be stable, we're going to need their help. And you got to get over this problem you have talking to people you disagree with or that you think aren't fit to talk to us. And it's time to redeploy the troops. That means get them out of harm's way in many cases. Put them out at air bases. Put them, keep some in Iraq so they can keep a lid on things. But let's not have them dying in the streets every day. That was the Baker-Hamilton's primary recommendation. Now, the Bush administration latched on to one piece of it that said, well, we could see where a temporary surge of maybe 20,000 troops could be useful if, in fact, the purpose is to tamp down sectarian violence and to give the Iraqi government breathing space to effect a political solution, political compromise. But what a lot of people don't know is that that clause was inserted with a lot of lobbying and pressure from the Bush administration. They basically worked the Republicans on the panel, and both Baker and Hamilton weren't going to produce a report that didn't have unanimity, all 10 people, and bipartisan support, all 5 Republicans, all 5 Democrats, signing on to a unanimous recommendation, a unanimous set of recommendations. And so they inserted this issue about, yeah, we could see a temporary surge, but this was hardly the main piece of the report, and it was inserted at the behest of the Bush administration. And then when the report comes out, Bush says, I'm going to do the surge. A lot of people in the Pentagon were against it. A lot of people in Congress were against it. A lot of people in the administration were against it. And he has the gall, as he's explaining why he's doing the surge, that to claim that he's taking the advice of the Baker-Hamilton report. No, you're doing what you plan to do anyway, and you exerted political pressure to get the idea of a surge inserted as one minor component or option within the Baker-Hamilton report. You don't hear people report on that much, but that's the way it went down. The other thing you don't hear report on very much is that George W. Bush had to get rid of 2 generals. Peter Pace was one of them, and I'm trying to remember who the other one was. But they were, one was head of the Joint Chiefs, the other, I think, was in line to be head of the Joint Chiefs, or perhaps was it the guy in Iraq, another general in Iraq besides Pace. In any case, neither of them would sign up for the surge. And so he went through a number of different generals, and he came upon Petraeus, who believed in counterinsurgency, had written the manual on counterinsurgency, and the Bush administration, after 4 years, admitted they were facing an insurgency. And so they thought, well, let's put the guy who wrote the book on counterinsurgency in charge. And Petraeus said, yes, I will manage your surge for you. He got his 4th star. In other words, he got a promotion. So he's on the fast track by being willing to do what Bush wanted. But then within a couple of months, as Bush started calling this the Petraeus report that we'd get, he started, when reporters said things like, well, Mr. President, your surge, what if your surge doesn't work? And he said, hey, it's not my surge. This is General Petraeus's surge. And this is something that's bothered me about George W. Bush, his whole administration, is that he is hidden behind the military. You talk about disrespecting the military. George W. Bush hides behind the rank and file. He hides behind the soldiers that are, you know, the enlisted men, and he hides behind the generals. He hides behind the soldiers by putting out this argument that you're unpatriotic if you disagree with me. And we must support the troops. You must give me the $50 billion, the $100 billion, the $200 billion, whatever it is he's asking for this month, or you don't support the troops. As though they're not going to get their food or their bullets or their armored Humvees. And secondly, he hides behind the generals by saying, well, I trust the generals on the ground. Yeah, when they agree with you, you trust them. But when they speak up and suggest something different, you push them aside and get someone that will agree with you. And this goes back to General Shinseki in 2003, who said we need many more. We need 250,000, 350,000 troops to do this, not the 150 that Rumsfeld wants to go in with. In fact, Rumsfeld wanted to go in with even a smaller footprint, and he was persuaded to go in with 150 ultimately. In any case, back to Petraeus and how he ended up in the job he's in, I'm not saying he doesn't believe it. I'm not saying he's not a good man. I'm not saying he doesn't have integrity. I'm saying that we shouldn't assume any one person has a crystal ball, or any one person is got the, quote, correct view of Iraq. Because anybody's going to have a skewed view, but if you've got a vested interest, even though you can see the situation on the ground, your biases are going to come out one way or the other. So General Petraeus has biases, and I'll let you know about two more biases that he has. The first is that he wrote an op-ed piece, I think it was in the New York Times, but he wrote an op-ed piece in October of 2004, right before the 2004 election, saying, in essence, we're making progress in Iraq, that the hope for the new elections, it looks like sectarian forces are starting to work together, compromise, etc. All the stuff that suggested success is around the corner. Well, that's the problem with the entire Bush administration, with Bush and Cheney, is that their predictions have been wrong so often. The idea that now we are going to sit back and listen one more time to him saying, you know, give us 6 to 9 months, success is around the corner. Fool me once, shame on you, as the president says in his famous Bushism, fool me, we can't get fooled again. As he misquoted the WHO. In any case, Petraeus not only wrote this partisan op-ed in the right before the 2004 election that, you know, helped solidify support for the war right before Bush was reelected, not something a military man should probably be doing. But tonight, he gave an exclusive interview to Brit Hume of Fox News. Now, Fox News is the most partisan of the networks. They clearly are on the Republican / conservative side. You see it in their programming. You see it in the people that host their shows and the people that fill in for their hosts. You see it in the number of times people like Newt Gingrich, Ann Coulter, whoever you want to name, are guests. And you see it when you see their roundtables that include, you know, 3 or 4 conservatives at a time and 1 or 0 liberals, or actually straight journalists. So, and you see it in Roger Ailes, a former Republican operative, being president of the network. So General Petraeus, in his wisdom, decided to give Fox News a 1-hour exclusive interview tonight. You know, why not do a press conference and let people ask questions? Why not sit down with, you know, a panel from all 4 networks? So that's just another, I think it's a mistake on the Bush administration's part to have him do this or let him do this. It sends the wrong message, unless what you're trying to do is primarily a political exercise, which they claim it isn't. And the last thing I'll share about General Petraeus in terms of his background is that I saw a little report in the last couple of weeks that his dissertation for his PhD, which I think was at Princeton University in, I guess it was 87 perhaps, was on the war in Vietnam, the lessons of Vietnam. And basically, the kinds of things he wrote was that the lesson of Vietnam is that you have to unleash the military. These are my words, not his. But they didn't let the military go out and win that war. They put all kinds of restraints on what they could do. The implication being, as people like Melanie Morgan have said and other arch conservatives, that if you'd let us go in and lay waste to the country, we could have won that thing. That is a fundamental misread. Now, I don't know if the Petraeus still holds that view, okay? But that is a fundamental misread, as we've talked about on this show before, of the nature of home court advantage in war. You can dominate a people with enough firepower and enough boots on the ground for a short period of time, but eventually you have to leave because they live there and they have too many advantages in terms of running a guerrilla war against you, an insurgency, whatever you want to call it. So it doesn't make a lot of sense to me, but Petraeus seems to share Bush's view, which is the lesson of Vietnam is what most conservatives and Republicans think the lessons of Vietnam are, not what McNamara learned about Vietnam, which was that you go into somebody else's culture without understanding it, and you pay the price, and you can't hold somebody else's country because they have home court advantage, home field advantage. But rather, if you use your firepower and you go all out, you can kick butt, as the president said recently. He said in Australia, he told somebody that over there, we're kicking butt in Iraq. Yeah. In any case, we're going to take a short break. And when we come back, we are going to talk a little bit more about the nature of the surge and where this whole thing is likely to take us.
Greetings, sensationalists from across the fruity plains.
You're listening to the Andy Finn Show,
the smooth talk of the town.
Cool. We are back on the Andy Finn Show, and let's talk a little bit about the other studies that have been done. The GAO report came out recently, and the GAO, there are 18 benchmarks that Congress put in the original, the original bill back in January that approved the surge. And the Bush administration argued that the Iraqi government was meeting 8 or 9 of them, and maybe partially a couple more or something. So they gave them a pretty good grade recently. But the GAO said they only met 3, I believe. And the Pentagon objected. Now, the GAO, the Government Accountability Office, is an independent arm of research arm of the Congress, and it is nonpartisan. They do dozens and dozens of reports a month, I suppose, but certainly a year, about all kinds of things. They analyze Social Security. They analyze the economy. They analyze programs, whether they're working. And they give you pretty good information because you got people from both the Republican and the Democratic side making sure that it's not slanted one way or the other. So the GAO report was pretty hard on the Iraqi government and what they had achieved in terms of these benchmarks. These 18 benchmarks are not for us. They're for the Iraqi government. And the Pentagon pushed back and said, oh, we want to talk to you and give you more information before you put out your final report. We think that there's more progress than you're seeing. And in fact, somebody had leaked the GAO report, the preliminary draft, because they knew that the GAO was being pressured by the Pentagon and the Bush administration to make it look better than they were willing to make it look. And in the end, the GAO came out with a report that said they're meeting these 3 benchmarks and there's partial progress on 2 more. So they compromised a little bit. But it still is a pretty serious indictment of the Iraqi government. So let's review what the Iraqi government, what we want them to do. The Maliki government is relatively weak. Maliki is a Sunni, a Shia, who seems to not want to cross Muqta al-Sadr, the head Shia cleric, who has a lot of militia. When we started the surge, he took a vacation, let's say, in Iran. He actually feared for his life, the reports are, and who knows that he didn't have good reason. But he has, 20,000-30,000 militia that is loosely report to him or that are loyal to him. But he leaves the country, and the militias are on their own. And when he came back, it's not that he had great control over them ever, because these are loose confederations. But when he came back, he had less control than before. So it's not clear he can even control his own militia. But Muqta al-Sadr is back, and Maliki doesn't really want to cross him, although he did give the coalition troops, the Americans, the British, and others, permission to go after the death squads and the renegade insurgents that were part of the that might have been part of Sadr's thing, but that were part of the Iraqi army. And so they have been making a little bit of progress there. But the problem is Maliki's a little too weak. It doesn't seem his heart is in this. Now, what the U.S. wants him to do is several things. They want him to compromise with the Sunnis and the Kurds in the government.
to produce several agreements. One is an agreement to share oil revenue. Basically, 50% of the country is Shia, mostly in the south in Baghdad. 20% is Sunni, the same party that the Ba'ath Party is from, that that Saddam was from and that ruled from and ruled Iraq for the last 30 years or more. And then the Kurds, who are 30%. So the Sunnis are only 20%, but they've been running the country for a long time. So it's pretty obvious that if you hold elections, the Sunnis are going to lose out. Well, they resisted joining the government for a while because they didn't think they were getting a fair shake. And it turns out none of the oil is under Sunni land. The oil is primarily under Shia land, where the Shia live in the south, and there's some, quite a bit, in the north where the Kurds are. And so you've got these three factions, and the Bush administration believed from the beginning that you could take these three factions, who, by the way, two of them have been warring for 900 years, is that about right? Maybe it's 1,300 years? Yeah, 1,300 years, since about the 700s, when the Shia and the Sunni, one of them was founded and then the other broke with them. And so these are intractable problems, but we believe we could go in there and paper over them and get these folks to play nice together. Now, I've voiced this before, but the fear I have is that the Shia, since they know they're the majority, they're about 50%, can wait until the Americans leave before they settle scores. But it's not that they haven't been settling scores. There have been death squads out there, and there have been people settling scores. But it may very well be that they have no intention of reconciliation. So whatever we're doing, we may simply be keeping a lid on things for a period of time. And then when we leave, there's going to be a bloodbath. Now, what people are saying is, we can't afford to leave now. It would be irresponsible to cut and run, to pull our troops out now. You know, the Pottery Barn rule, according to Colin Powell, if you break it, you own it. It is true. We broke Iraq. We own it. The problem is that we could stay another 5 years, and there might still be a bloodbath when we left. And there's no good way to know that at one level, but it'd be nice if we hadn't gone in. So anyway, the Maliki government, we have these 18 benchmarks, but we want them to do several things primarily. One is the oil revenue, oil sharing plan, because the Sunnis have no oil, but if the country doesn't bequeath about 20% of the oil to the Sunnis in a formal kind of an agreement, the Sunnis aren't going to be satisfied not getting any resources. Secondly, they want to have it's got to be a national reconciliation kind of thing, but they want to have a power-sharing arrangement whereby they can agree on who gets what ministries or how many ministries and all of that. And there are a couple of other major benchmarks where it's essentially about power-sharing. And right now, Maliki is not strong enough as a president to force to make this happen, or else he's not a good enough diplomat, or else the sides just don't want to compromise. There's a couple of problems. Like I say, the Shia may very well be biding their time and waiting for a chance to get revenge. After all, Saddam and his party, who were all Sunnis, held down the Shia, killed a lot of Shia, killed a lot of Kurds over the years. And this is pretty much still, there's quite a bit of westernization in Iraq. There's plenty of people who've been educated in the West and gone back, although most of those have fled. But there's a lot of tribalism in Iraq still, and a lot of fundamentalism. So it's not clear that they're all interested in reconciliation. The other piece of it is that, in addition to the fact the Shia are 50% or so of the country, and they may want revenge. The Sunnis, when polls are done among Sunnis, they believe that they are about 50%. Now, they're 20% of the country, but they believe they're about half the country. And they were in power, and they were deposed when we went in. And so they think their rightful place is to have an equal share. Well, guess what? They're not going to get an equal share. They have 20% of the population. They're going to get about a 20% share of power and 20% of the oil revenues. And frankly, that's more oil than they deserve, since the oil's not primarily under Sunni lands. So there's that dilemma. And then the third component is the Kurds. Now, things are pretty peaceful in the Kurdish areas in the north, and they are pretty much autonomous. They don't have that much interest in being part of a centralized government. They've got their oil. They've got their lands up north. Now that Saddam's no longer gassing them and strafing them from his helicopters, they're pretty happy. The problem is that they may want independence at some point. And so this is what's worried Turkey, and it's what worried Turkey before we went in. It's why that Turkey counseled us not to go in, and it's why Turkey feared that what would happen was that once you lose your strongman, in the same way when Tito was gone in Yugoslavia, in fact, when the Iron Curtain fell, Yugoslavia broke up, and the various factions in Yugoslavia went to war. That's what the Kosovo War was all about. So, the same kind of thing Turkey was worried would happen in Iraq, because Iraq is not a natural boundaries with these three factions. The British put this together back in a time when Western powers could dictate what went on in the Middle East. But it doesn't make a lot of sense, and in the same way that Yugoslavia went through a tremendous amount of churn when the strongman was removed, we've removed the strongman by choice in Iraq, thinking that, oh, well, we can get these people to buy into democracy. So when we come back, we'll talk a little bit about why it's so difficult to bring democracy and elections. Well, you can bring elections, but democracy and freedom to a tribal people.